Jim Ausman. I'm introducing this section on pediatric neurosurgery brain tumors, which is part of the SNI digital meeting on June 5th and 6th, 2021. That was an international meeting with participants from over 100, from 100 countries or more. This session is moderated by Chandra Deojapari. Dale Pujari from India. He's professor and head of neurosurgery at Bombay Hospital Institute in Mumbai, India. He is accomplished in endoscopic surgery, pediatric neurosurgery, and cerebrovascular neurosurgery. The neurosurgeons in India I found were extremely capable people, were very busy because there weren't a lot of them. And they did very, very good work, but often didn't have time to write. Chandra has done an outstanding job, has run a number of courses, Zoom courses throughout India, and is well recognized. His assistant moderator is Shlomo Constantini, who is head of pediatric neuroscience and neurosurgery at the Herzliya Medical Center in Tel Aviv, Israel. Shlomo is an excellent teacher, very practical person, been in pediatric neurosurgery for years, and has an excellent practice and excellent reputation. They've assembled some participants from around the world. Sergio Cavalheiro from Sao Paulo, Brazil, is professor of neurosurgery there. Rakesh Jalal is from Mumbai, India. He's a neuro-oncologist who specializes in radiation oncology. Dr. Kulkarni, professor of neurosurgery from the University of Toronto Hospital from SickKids. Abbe Kulkarni is his name. Sandy Lam is professor of neurosurgery at the Pediatric Hospital in Chicago, associated with Northwestern University. She was with us as a resident at UCLA, did an outstanding job. Nobel Tango is a young neurosurgeon who's in pediatric neurosurgery at the Red Cross Children's Hospital in Cape Town, South Africa. A delightful, young, experienced pediatric neurosurgeon. You'll hear from her. And Frank von Kallenberg. Frank is a professor of pediatric neurosurgery at the university in Leuven in Belgium. So there's a number of people here you will hear in the audio, you'll see on the video, and they're going to discuss two subjects. The first half hour is going to be devoted to craniopharyngioma and what are the treatments for it. They'll present cases and talk about the various approaches. Chandra will show an endoscopic approach that in which they're introducing a new concept where you can remove actually grossly the tumor. It's a very interesting video to see, and there are new advances in the molecular structures of craniopharyngioma, all of which are making it more approachable and treatable than it had been in the past. The second half is going to be devoted to medulloblastoma, another common pediatric brain tumor that's seen around the world, and various people will discuss that from their perspectives as neurosurgeons and radiotherapists, in addition to the chemotherapy. We hope you enjoy this session. It's an outstanding session, in my opinion. Thank you very much for coming.
So welcome, friends. We are at the SNI Neurosurgery World Education Summit, and in the pediatric tumor session, we are going to discuss two cases today. We have a lot of friends gathered here. A lot of young people from several countries in the world have joined us. And we hope that this case discussion, we have questions from them as well, which we will be answering. And we'll be discussing the case amongst ourselves as well as we go on. So this is a 9-year-old boy who came to us with early morning headaches associated with vomiting intermittently for a year, and they became worse in the last 2 months. This is one of the problems in the developing countries, that there is a late presentation the vomiting typically relieved after the headache. He has had a normal antenatal and perinatal history, normal milestones, and there were no changes in diet, weight, or urinary frequency before. So I would straight away take you to the imaging. Before that, we certainly had a clinical examination. We showed him to be reasonably cooperative. There was advanced papilledema in both the eyes, and remaining examination was normal. So at this stage, the first investigation, nowadays, fortunately, in India, we have several MRIs, and this was the investigation done at that time. Would you like to comment, Shlomi, on this MR?
Well, I see impressive hydrocephalus with extravasation of fluid around the ventricles, and this is obviously the reason of the papilledema. I see a suprastellar tumor. I would guess there are some calcifications. I would like to see a CT scan if it's available.
So let us see rest of the sequences. We have a cystic and a solid component. The solid component is mainly in the cella. The cystic component is growing upwards, and this is the CT scan.
Okay, so we've got it all. We've got it all. So we have a solid component in the cella, and we have a suprastellar cyst that blocks the third ventricle. This is the reason for the hydrocephalus. So
this boy is rapidly deteriorating, and he has this hydrocephalus with a suprastellar tumor. Abhay, would you like to tell us what should we do in this kind of a patient for the hydrocephalus, which is probably the predominant reason why he's developed such a severe papilledema?
So I'm sorry. So Chandrasekhar, you said he is now rapidly deteriorating. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
So in that situation, I mean, as Shlomi pointed out, this is a predominantly cystic tumor. It looks like a cranial pharyngioma with that calcified solid component in the cella causing obstructive hydrocephalus. Usually, I'd like to get some baseline testing of vision and in its hormone status. But in his child who's rapidly deteriorating, I think the hydrocephalus needs acute treatment. What I would do, I mean, our approach when you have a predominantly cystic tumor like this is actually to direct our initial mode of therapy for the tumor at the cyst as well. And so I think you could probably deal with that and treat the hydrocephalus by doing an endoscopic approach through the frontal horns into the foramen of Monroe. It looks like it's going to be dilated in that in the area of the cyst. And under the endoscope, I put in a reservoir catheter to decompress the cyst. I'd watch it decompress, and usually that relieves the hydrocephalus. And we then use that catheter for interferon therapy after. But you know, I would get a full assessment of what his vision status is like and what his endocrine status is like as well before making definitive decisions about the final management of the tumor.
Great. Sergio, would you like to agree with that? Would you do something more than just putting a catheter?
No. It's a very good case. I think it's a cystic cranial pharyngioma with intracranial hypertension. It's a kind of emergency. And I think to put a catheter guided by endoscopy, evacuate the cyst as it's possible, not a lot, because the catheter stays inside the cyst. You can solve the tumor and the hydrocephalus in first step. Then I'd like to know the hormonal, how is the hormonal in this patient? If it's the deterioration of the hormonal, I do direct surgery. If it's not, if there is no hormonal alteration, I introduce interferon.
Great. So this is what we actually did. I usually like to put the catheter directly in the cyst rather than putting a EVD. That was one point which Abhay also made and Sergio also made. So we are getting into the cyst. One of the problem is spillage, but fortunately under cover of steroids does not seem to have much of a reaction. And The only other way you can probably do it is try to put the stylet and reservoir straight away, rather the catheter straight away, rather than trying to perforate it. But this seems to have worked quite well for us. And we put in a catheter, we decompress the cyst, and the headaches improved remarkably. And the hormonal evaluation was sent. It takes about 3 days for all the results to come back. And during this time, the child was settling well. And we also got, this is the post-operative scan, which shows resolution of hydrocephalus. And at this time, we did a PNS CT scan to see what we should do as a future treatment. All the hormone reports came back as normal. So how would you go ahead further? This is a 6-year-old boy. There is no visual field defect, so very likely this is a retrochiasmal kind of a tumor.
Mm-hmm. Can I just ask the point that you made about the concern with spillage of the cyst content? So as you've noted, I've not really noted that to be a concern or an issue, and I'm just curious if other people worry about that, because I've actually stopped really worrying about it. It has not been an issue in terms of concern after.
Shlomi, you have one patient who reacted badly, but settled with steroids.
Yeah, I agree the spillage is not a big problem. I would like to keep the catheter inside the cyst, because if you elect to treat either by interferon, which I would not favor in this case, but if you would like to send to radiotherapy or to go transsphenoidal to the cella, it is nice to have a cyst, because the cyst reacts last. We've seen after proton therapy, we've seen cysts staying there for a year and sometimes for 2 years, and then they respond to the treatment. So it is very nice to keep the catheter in the cyst. And it's a challenge, because sometimes if you go 1 centimeter too deep or 1 centimeter too shallow, you're going to lose the cyst. And regarding the tumor, there are options out there, and I guess the controversy will never end. For me, I would drain the cyst and send to radiotherapy by protons. This is for me, because I think interferon is a temporizing measure and usually does not cure. There have been suggestions to just follow after you drain the cyst. I think the German study of following was aborted because all of the tumors, all of the craniopharyngiomas grew at one point. So waiting may give the advantage if you have very young children, not to irradiate them when they are young, but the tumors will grow. So for any child above 3 or 4, I would drain the cyst and send for irradiation. The problem with the transsphenoidal, I have seen a couple, at least 10 in the last few years, you get a diabetes insipidus. If you remove those tumors, you're going to get the eye. And it is such a shame to take a boy that is preserved endocrinologically and give him the eye. Of course, the eye can be managed if the thirst mechanism is there. So my choice would be drainage and radiotherapy upfront.
Frank, what would you do in such a case?
Yes, I want first to give a small comment, because you said, Chandra, that in developing countries, the diagnosis is often made after a delay of 1 year. I just want to say that in Belgium, which is not considered a developing country, these diagnoses are also made quite late, and many tumors are a lot bigger than this one at presentation. So I think this is everywhere in the world. When these children have complaints, even when their vision is getting bad, they are just advanced in the classroom closer to the teacher before the CT scan or MR is made. On the treatment, I think what we would have done was also put a catheter in the cyst under endoscopic guidance and leave it there with a reservoir and then go for radiotherapy. Personally, making the hole for the catheter, I would have taken a small biopsy of the cyst wall to be sure that it's a craniopharyngioma, to convince radiotherapists that it is a craniopharyngioma and not some sort of colloid cyst, because they don't always believe radiology. And then do radiotherapy and not go after the nodular tumor in the cella. The child was 9 years old, I think,
and six was,
or six seven. Years old. That's seven. Eight, 7 years old. The few cases where I send children to my colleague who's doing the adult pituitary surgery, they all got diabetes insipidus and poor results and never a complete resection. But it's only three or four cases.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Thango, what is your experience in your country? How would you manage this?
Thank you for the question. So, you know, in South Africa, they tend to present a lot bigger. The one thing in terms of endoscopic and doing an Amaya reservoir, I've had situations, obviously I'm still junior in my career, where there's cyst leakage and I get quite a bad chemical meningitis. We tend to do a leak test after we put in Amaya reservoir, and then if the child isn't yet at the age for radiotherapy, we try to tie them over with Intefera. This child's 9 years old, and visually, if there's improvements after cyst decompression, I wonder if one would follow up, and if they become symptomatic, refer to radiotherapy, just in case of, you know, it's lying quite close to the optic nerves, the cyst that I saw in MRI. But yeah, that's what we would kind of do, decompress the cyst. And then follow up with imaging.
Rakesh, I would like you to get in now to tell us what are the implications of the cyst in terms of planning radiation therapy, and do you need to update your radiation protocol or radiation field if you have a cyst there?
Thanks, Dr. Depujari. It's not an uncommon situation, as you know, in our practice. And I tend to agree with all the colleagues who have said about the indication of radiation. He's 7 years old. So we would definitely, in my previous institution, we used to do with IMRT or a VMAT technology, but now we have proton therapy, the image guided one in India as well. So we have treated in the last 2.5 years, number of them, including with yourself, Dr. Depujari. We always try to talk to the neurosurgical colleagues first, because occasionally in a younger person, especially in his case, because he is hormonally intact, you are tempted occasionally to observe very closely. But neurosurgeons know that this is going to recur. So if they tell us, no, it's very likely that it will, so you better treat. And also I'm encouraged by the fact that the vision is intact. So in our country, again, as perhaps is the case in many other places also, the follow-up may not be so good. And we don't want the tumor to come back and impair his vision. So we would go ahead with radiation. Coming to your specific point, in particular with proton, as some of you may know, it's a particle beam therapy. So any different density has to be very meticulously incorporated in the planning system, because it can actually perturb the dose. So you have to be extra careful. In our center, we do a weekly MRI and a daily CT as a part of imaging cone beam CT on the proton machine before you treat. And the other centers, for example, Shane Jules, have reported as much as 5% to 14% of change in the cystic volume, both increase, and sometimes we have seen decrease also. And that can change your proton planning. So in proton, you have to be extra careful, but it is done. It's not such a big deal. Or if you have the protocols in place, you can manage these children quite well.
Vani, have you joined us, Vani? No, she hasn't joined us. But Rakesh, one of the points which was made was you wanted to have a histopathology report. I mean, morphologically, this is nothing else but craniopharyngioma, not only on imaging, but also on inspection at surgery. Would you insist on a pathology?
Well, we tend to, it could be part of the oncology bit in us because that is kind of mandated in our training, you may say, or whatever you may call. And I mean, both of us know, and many of us know, that occasionally you do have surprises. And in a young child, to irradiate is a big deal. And, you know, it's like a lifelong thing. So ideally, yes, we would like to have a histopathology in my practice as well. So we tend to insist upon a histopathology. That is correct, I'm afraid.
So we have now treated about 28 patients with this kind of a protocol, that once after we put the cyst, if the child is too small and it is very difficult to or it is not advisable to go for a radical surgery, we would probably do interferon therapy in a child about 3 years. But if the child is otherwise intact and the radiology is favorable, like in this patient, you have a well aerated sphenoid sinus, and we tend to go after decompression, we tend to go transsphenoidal. And like in this patient, we have done a carotid to carotid exposure, we have done a plenum removal. After that, we are coagulating the anterior intracavernous sinus, opening up the corridor for the tumor. And you will find that all the solid tumor is in the cella. So once you have made an incision into the capsule, you get all the calcium out. Once the calcium comes out, the rest of the cyst starts getting drained, and the capsule, what is our experience mainly is that once you have drained the cyst, unlike one of our colleagues, I think, said that once you get this out, you find that the dome of the cyst starts falling into your view. And here you will find that it is not just pulling, you are easing out gently with your suction. And you will find as we go along, the cyst wall is coming out fairly easily. The normal pituitary is here at the back. And the dome of the cyst has almost completely fallen into your cella. And this is a portion attached to one side. There has been no, we are just easing the tumor out. We are not pulling the tumor out. And I think this kind of a cyst wall falling into your field would not happen unless you have previously done a cyst decompression by the endoscopic intraventricular kind of an approach. And the whole tumor has come out. You can actually start seeing this inside, and you will be able to see the pituitary stalk plastered onto one side over here, which was intact. The closure is, of course, in three layers with fat, fascia, and nasoseptal flap. And this patient recovered quite well following surgery. He had mandatory diabetes insipidus. Hypernatremia, had seizures for a day, and this took about 3 days to recover. But from post-operative fourth day, he recovered to normalcy, needed minerin for about 3 weeks. And thereafter, that has been reduced, and he's only on Hysone currently. And this is the MRI done at 3 months, where he's receiving only steroids at a dose of about 5 milligrams of Hysone in the morning. 10 in the morning and 5 in the evening. And this is the post-operative scan. So my question is, I know that there is a lot of discussion on how radical one should be, but when the patient is hormonally intact, when the hypothalamus is not involved, should we do a radical surgery or not, which can be a curative, is still a matter of controversy. And I would be very happy to hear from all the faculty their opinions.
This is Sandy Lamb. That was a great case. Thank you for showing that. And I think it highlights a lot about the whole spectrum of options for approaching this. And I'm glad you showed the resection spectrum, part of the spectrum as well. In terms of the first decision point for addressing the hydrocephalus and the cyst, absolutely agree, endoscopic approach getting a sample of the lesion for our pathology colleagues and for the whole multidisciplinary care for discussion for radiation, absolutely agree. And I think the other point is contribution to discovery and science. If you are at a center that participates in a registry, we send all of our craniopharyngioma cyst fluid and any tissue sample to Colorado with Todd Hankinson's group, and they have 18 centers storing the tissue and having a collaboration with the UK. So that, if you are able to safely obtain tissue sample, I think that's an important component as well. And then putting a catheter under direct visualization. If there was an additional cyst, if you're able to configure your catheter in a way to be able to address multiple cystic cavities, that's also a consideration. In this case, that was not. And then I think the big decision point is, if you are going to consider surgical resection with the goal of maximal safe resection, then your timing is just as you showed it. It's upfront, right? It's before you go to radiation. And then you choose that path. I think that the way to run into a lot of trouble is if you choose radiation up front and then later on decide to go for maximal safe resection, because that makes the tissues much more difficult to work with. So I think this case was wonderfully chosen because you were able to highlight a lot of the controversies and the ways that all of us approach this differently.
Abhay, what is the situation in Canada? I know in Europe, radical resection is virtually given up. Do you have any views on this?
So we usually put, so in the case like this, I think the treatment algorithm would have been, you know, put the cyst catheter in, drain the cyst, and we probably would have started with interferon, recognizing that's not a cure, obviously. I think our philosophy is that this is a potentially chronic condition, and to manage it as such, and to try to minimize the aggressiveness and morbidity of interventions for as long as possible, as long as it's safe to do so. Because yes, you know, the interferon isn't going to cure this, but that may control symptoms and not harm future interventions, whether it be surgery or radiation. And defer the morbidity that comes with both. You know, the it was an excellent resection that you showed, but the child has DI and will likely have other hormonal deficits, whether it's a result of surgery or radiation. So the more minimal approach would be to start with the interferon, and if there is change that cannot be managed with interferon, that is any growth in the solid component, then we would have a discussion with the family, because I think both would be good options. We talked about upfront radiation versus surgery, but this is certainly one that would be considered for surgery, and would involve a discussion with the family as to where their risk tolerance is and what their preferences are. But I think both would be reasonable options here, and I don't think we'd be dogmatic about one versus the other.
So about the diabetes insipidus, we have the patients we have treated like this. We have about 25% patients who required a long-term diabetes insipidus treatment. Otherwise, all other 75% of the children actually did not require any medication for diabetes insipidus beyond 12 months. That is our experience. So yes, I mean, all this has to be explained. That is extremely important. Rakesh, would you say anything on this choice of approach?
Yeah.
When you have a complete excision, or when you do not see any residual tumor on the postoperative MRI, there is still a possibility of recurrence. So what is the status after radical resection about wait and watch, or go for upfront radiation?
you know, when we were students, we were taught that you speak to the neurosurgeon if there is anything left near the stalk. Even if you don't see anything on the MR, it's going to grow. So probably treat radiation. But it has evolved over a period of time. The MRIs are much nicer. There's a greater cooperation. I think in the past, there was not so much interaction also as a multidisciplinary approach, as was mentioned by one of the speakers. I think if you follow it closely, both of us, Dr. Depujari and you and me, we have a number of cases which we are following very closely as well. So that is a very reasonable approach. As a radiation oncologist, we always try to avoid as much as possible, especially in young children, even with protons. But at the end of the day, in many countries, I have a feeling based not only in cranial, but in general oncology, sometimes first chance is the best chance. So you have to really individualize and customize to each child and the family.
Dr. Kango, your comments before I go to our European colleagues.
Thanks. I think a lot has been covered already, so I don't have any additional comments, except I was quite impressed with the endoscopic approach. In our center, the children tend to come a lot younger, 4 or 5 years old. I just wanted to ask, what is your age limit for going endoscopic in a pediatric patient?
We have treated as young as 2 years, 10 months, but generally we would not consider below the age of 5 months unless they have a very good aerated sphenoid.
Thank you.
Shlomi, I think you and Frank would comment before we move to the next case.
I just want to make sure you call me up as a European representative.
Well,
I can be European, Asian, African, whatever you choose.
Right. You can choose to be wherever.
Now, I think what is striking is really the relative coherence of potential solutions among this group sitting here. Because if you would add on a adult neurosurgeons, you would see a much more aggressive surgically opinion. And it's hard to convince them that radiotherapy, in principle, is effective for craniopharyngiomas. The problems I face is when we have large craniopharyngiomas with large solid components. We recently had a couple of, let's say, 4 or 5 centimeter diameter craniopharyngioma with a small cyst or no cyst. What do you do then? So I would like to reverse the question to Rakesh and ask, what would be his upper limit for proton beams or for any radiotherapy with a large craniopharyngioma? Would making a 4 centimeter craniopharyngioma, 2 centimeter craniopharyngioma, would that make a difference for you in terms of mobility of your radiotherapy and efficacy of radiotherapy?
That's a great question, and we do see such cases. Problem comes if it is a upfront case. Obviously, as small tumor that we have to treat, it is better. And particularly now, we have very good data. By the way, the long-term efficacy of radiation in our own series with a cohort of almost 100-odd patients over followed with 7 years with the prospective neuroendocrine neurocognitive data is 7 year survival of 95%. So that I completely agree, it is pretty effective. The problem actually comes in recurrence. Sometimes patients are observed, not given radiation. There's a small 1 centimeter, becomes 2 centimeter. Occasionally you operate, suddenly after 3-4 surgeries, you have now 4 centimeter tumor, and then it is sent to be for radiation. And those are extremely difficult tumors because they have had so many surgical resections. And so our approach also has been, as I mentioned, to try to intervene as early as possible. Obviously, as you know, the larger the tumor, the more side effects. However, there is a small benefit with proton, because proton, even if it's a slightly larger tumor, I have to say you can achieve beautiful dose distributions, particularly to the left hippocampi and also to the other organs at risk. But the pituitary hypothalamic axis is, of course, part of the target volume. You cannot avoid it. So, you know, it's again case-to-case basis.
Great. Sergio, have you become more conservative? Are you still doing some endoscopic resections?
Yes, yes. The youngest patient is, I think, is 2 years old, is the same. It's the pain of the sphenoid. But one thing in that case, I have a similar case like that. I cut the catheter, because if you left the catheter, perhaps you have cells of the cranial pharyngioma that can grow. So by the transsphenoid, I cut the catheter. Second point of view, I'd like to see in the beginning of the surgery, the optic pathway. In the beginning, I don't do that. Sometimes the post-chiasmatic cranial pharyngioma, I don't do that. But now, it's my technique, it's obliged to see the optic pathway before to begin the surgery. What do you think about that?
Well, I think in a retrochiasmal craniopharyngioma, it certainly makes it difficult. And that is one reason why you cannot even think of doing a radical resection from a transcranial approach. I think for this particular kind of a tumor, which is retrochiasmal, does not have field defects or optic nerve deficit, and if the cella is well aerated, these are our indications to go for this kind of a surgery. I think, Frank, you have any last comment before we move?
No, just that it was a very impressive video of this transsphenoidal resection. I personally never did transsphenoidal surgery, so I have to send these patients to my colleagues. I was impressed. That's all that I want to say.
I think I personally have started thinking that probably the adherence to the hypothalamus can be minimized by draining the cyst, and thereafter it becomes easier from the experience we have had so far. We don't try to be very radical unless it peels out easily. Otherwise, the patients go for either photon or proton radiotherapy. I will move over to the next case. I would request Shlomi to moderate this case.
Thank you, Chandra. Will you show the case?
I'm showing. The second case is a six-year-old boy who presented with giddiness and vomiting for about a week, has headaches for the 2 days before he came to us, and the parents noticed an imbalance while walking just the day before he came. And only after he had this fall, they brought it to us. There was a clear ataxic gait, and this was the scan.
Any papilledema?
There was papilledema, though the child was very, very difficult to examine. He was very cranky, and he came with this scan. So I must say that I didn't really bother to look into his eyes.
Is it restricted?
Sorry?
Was it restricted on MRI? I mean,
yes. We come to that image in a moment. This is the post contrast image. This is in the coronal and sagittal view. And this is the spectroscopy. And this is the diffusion restriction. And what do you call it? Perfusion image as well.
Do you insist on spinal imaging before the surgery? That would be nice.
Yes. If the patient comes primarily to us, we would do a spine screen. But many a times what happens is patients come in a bad condition and they come with an MRI from outside. In such patients, we do it post-resection. MRI, that time we do a spine screen. But this was, frankly, showed diffusion restriction. So how do we proceed? I think please take over, Lomi.
Yeah. So the first thing is the controversy about how to deal with the CSF issues and the hydrocephalus. And there are several options here. So let's hear the panelists. Sergio, would you start with how to deal with the hydrocephalus? What would you do?
The first thing you can do, the third ventriculostomy or put your shunt, is depending on when you're going to surgery. If I'm going to do a surgery 1 or 2 days after, I put your shunt. If I'm going to wait 1 week, I do a third ventriculostomy.
Okay. Sandy?
I actually put in a ventriculostomy up front. It will help if the patient needs further imaging or spine imaging, it helps with the sedation. And then also perioperatively, after I do the posterior fossa tumor resection, the CSF diversion actually helps with the wound closure and healing. And then I see if I can actually wean the ventriculostomy and take it out. If the patient cannot have the ventriculostomy weaned, I do an endoscopic third ventriculostomy at that time through the same tract.
So you would do an EVD at the same setting as the surgical removal of the tumor?
Before the resection.
Impregnated EVD. Yeah, it was interesting because we had a similar discussion a few weeks ago, and our esteemed colleague Muhammad El-Batalgi from Cairo does a lot of these, said they do only shunts because in their setting, EVDs get infected. So it's geographically determined sometimes, because handling an EVD for a few days until it clears and to challenge it, and it may leak, may lead to other troubles. So if you have a good ICU with good personnel and you can clean it, that could be nice, because not all of them will require a shunt. So that would be nice. Ab, what do you say? What do you do in Toronto for handling the hydrocephalus?
EVD at the time of resection. So this child would be planned for a fairly acute resection of the tumor, and we would do an EVD just prior to tumor resection.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Thango, what would you do?
As I said, I'm still very early in my career, so with the bigger posterior fossa tumors, I do it with Prof. Higaji observing me. So we start off with an EVD. This gives us enough time to get craniospinal imaging, because post-op with blood and sedimentation, it's very difficult to see whether they're sugar coating. And then we tend to do it on the next available elective slate. So EVD is an emergency, do MRI cranial and spine imaging, then move on to the resection on our elective slates. Thanks. Yeah.
So EVD or an ETV can be a temporizing measure, especially for places that are not built to do these tumors in the middle of the night or have no availability on the next day. That sounds reasonable. I'm cooled off ETVs, I must say, because when you finish the surgery, if you do proper removal, the aqueduct is fully open. So what is the sense of doing an ETV when the brainstem is pushed anteriorly by the tumor? So I'm not against it, but I've been losing a little bit my enthusiasm for doing an ETV as a temporizing measure, but it's also a valid option. Did you start to show us the surgery, Chandra?
Yes, so is there anybody who will propose ETV first before surgery, or even, in place of EVD? None of our panelists is very keen on it.
I think in Paris, it is quite common, right?
Yes, that they propose it for virtually every posterior fossa tumor. Okay, so we did a midline craniotomy. We usually in acute conditions we do even a C1 laminotomy, and then the tumor is being dissected out by the telovelar approach. The video is not far too long, but I can pass forward it if we have pressure of time. It's a nodular, multinodular kind of a tumor. We are proceeding further with removal. We can start seeing the fourth ventricular floor now.
Chandra, how is the patient positioned? Face down?
Patient is positioned face down, yes.
Oh, good.
So further removal, and we fortunately did not have to do any Vermian split. The tumor is nicely peeling out now, and this is the last nodule coming out, and the aqueduct is getting free now. You can start seeing the aqueduct now, mm-hmm. and a layer of tumor on that. So luckily, except for we thought there was adherence, but there was really no adherence. We could get the whole tumor out. You can see a couple of places there is some irregularity, but otherwise the whole floor is clean, and you got a whole thing removed from obex to and this is the immediate post-operative CT scan, and this is the I can't find the immediate post-op MRI, but it showed a quite a radical excision. This is the immediate histopathology. Is Vani joined us yet? No. So nodular medulloblastoma was the report, and then as is currently practiced, we got a molecular biology done. So this seems to be a non-SSH,
WNT.
WNT, yes. Tumor. No metastasis observed on spine screen or brain screen. So how do we proceed further?
But Chandra, let me ask you a question. First of all, I see that everything works so well in Mumbai. So I think I'm going to come to Mumbai. My medulloblastomas are not so nice. You know, they're adhering to the peduncle on the sides, and I have a lot of major decisions.
Yes, it does happen in multinodular tumors. Probably they are easier to remove. I mean, this is the post-op scan, MR scan, if you would like to see.
Yes. I would like to ask, does anybody use sitting position anymore? Anybody in the among the panelists?
No, we've never used it, no.
No. So sitting position is kind of dead for most pediatric indications. That is interesting. I want to ask the panelists also, does anybody share my opinion that we are far too aggressive in medulloblastomas than we should be? Because the oncologists are twisting our arms according to this criteria of not to leave more than 2 cc's and et cetera, et cetera. Or I'm in minority again.
I think as long as it comes out easily, yes, but I wouldn't like to remove parts which are very adherent to the brainstem, but I would like to hear Sandy, Sergio, what they have to say.
I don't know if it's the problem with my oncologist all the time. When I remove the medulloblastoma, I put in my mind the face of my oncologist and try to remove as possible. And when I finish, let me see if there is a small piece and try to completely remove the tumor.
Same problem.
Yes.
You know, I wish the oncologist would find a solution and not push us to be so aggressive.
Yeah,
I can.
You know, I think most people would accept that on metastatic presentation, not to be aggressive with the initial tumor, right?
Yeah.
I think everybody would accept that. So,
yes.
And to give neoadjuvant right away, right? Instead of gaining this 20% at least of osteophyte mutism, right? I find the mutism to be so tricky. Sometimes you have a tumor that comes out so beautifully and the patient still has mutism. So what are your tricks to avoid mutism?
So anybody gentle. Trick?
Luckily, this patient came out quite well, but we would like to know how Abhay would treat this patient, how Frank.
Well, I think we would have given steroids and not put an EVD immediately, and put the EVD just before the surgery and try to wean it and remove it after a few days.
This was put at the beginning of surgery. EVD was put, the patient was operated within 24 hours of presentation to us.
And then the same approach face down, I always stand at the left side of the patient and I look into the aqueduct direction and I try to remove as much as possible, if possible completely, and leave as little as possible and not try to leave 1.5 milliliters like the oncologist's limit is. But when I saw the T2 images preoperatively, it looked like almost all the tumor was surrounded by a small CSF plane in the ventricles. I think this is very important. And I would have debulked first using the CUSA. Did you use CUSA?
I did not use CUSA because it was coming nicely in suction and my tumor forceps, so I did not need it, the CUSA, if I may say that.
Sandy, what is your trick to avoid mutism?
I think if I had that trick, we would all know it and we would all be doing it. And I think we've all faced this challenge that we do technically the best surgery we can, and we still have patients that we have to go through that journey of mutism for. Over time, my bony opening, it has actually gotten bigger to try to avoid manipulation of the vermis or even that telovelar splitting. I actually try to allow the cerebellum to be able to relax out and work really from the, and I always do a C1 laminectomy so that direction coming from that C1 area looking up towards the aqueduct is really ergonomic and open to try to avoid manipulation, and then to have that kind of long cottonoid or cotton patty to lay down and protect the brainstem. And I think over the course of all of our careers, we've seen a shift in thinking about how to treat medulloblastoma and the role of oncology and really, you know, having this be a medical disease, especially at time of recurrence, is a evolving and emerging a concept that I'd love to hear Dr. Kulkarni actually see how in the course of his career, especially with Mike Taylor and the whole Eric Buffet group being your immediate partners, how you've seen that change in how you approach surgery and treatment over time.
So I think, Shlomi, we have only 3 minutes left. So maybe Abhay has to make a comment and then Rakesh.
Okay.
Yeah, so to Sandy's point, clearly we're looking at more individualized treatment now and in a more nuanced way. I don't know that it's radically affected our surgical approach, though. And to what Shlomi was saying about, you know, the aggressiveness, we're still aggressive, rightly or wrongly, with surgery. And I'm sort of okay with that, because if I knew that more aggressive surgery led to more mutism, I'd be hesitant about it. But as we've just pointed out, we have some surgeries that you think are the easiest, most beautiful operations, and you think the kid's going to be fine, and they end up with mutism. And then others where it's a really tough operation, and you think, oh, this kid's in trouble, and they're fine. And so I can't correlate the aggressiveness of my resection with their outcome, which is frustrating. But it also gives me some cover in feeling okay to be aggressive with these surgeries.
Thank you. So maybe Rakesh, the last one, to tell us whether it's really justified to send medulloblastomas for protons.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think it is a very nice indication because you can spare a significant amount of tissue. But I wanted to make a comment on the oncology perspective from the molecular point of view. So obviously, the larger the tumor, this 1.5 square centimeter being the cutoff and shows 20-30% difference in outcome, but also was spurred by a rather retrospective group analysis of 700 odd patients where they saw which was the tumor in molecularly which made the greatest impact on surgical resection. And actually it was the group 4, the one that we are talking about, which actually happens to be the largest group. And I could see, we have done this radiogenomic study which published in Neuro-Oncology, that based on characteristic MRI, as you can actually predict to some extent as to what this tumor might be molecularly. And the NTR, the near total resection versus the other resection, was most profound seen in
Mike, group 4. Are we running out of time?
Yes, sir, we are out of time.
Okay, very last comment.
Just another minute.
if it is looking like a wind pathway towards the CP angle, they are the best tumors. If you want to leave a little bit, that's okay, because there the outcome is excellent.
Okay. Chandra, we're going to wrap up, right?
Yes. Thank you very much, Lomi, Sandy, Sergio, Frank, Rakesh. I'm sorry, Vani could not join us. I'm sure there are some technical issues. And thanks, Mike, for all the arrangements. Thank you very much for, we should be leaving because we have to make the stage for the next session.
Thank you very much.
Good night, India. Good day for people who are.
Thank you very much. Thank you.